Welcome to the Tech Lounge with me, Christian Schiller. And in the Tech Lounge this episode, I have Den O'Dell talking about a book he has coming out soon with Manning on Fast by Default, all about performance engineering. I've actually reviewed some of the book already, and it has some really interesting insights on justifying improving performance on whatever metric that you may need to use to justify it, as well as practical ways to then implement performance engineering at different levels of the stack, and then monitoring and iterating, etc., etc. What I read so far has a lot of really good detail, so I hope you will enjoy the interview and enjoy the book when it does come out. Head on over to go.christianscheller.com/Manning for more on that book and many other books in the Manning catalog. Enjoy.
So, Den, how are you today?
I'm doing really well, Chris. Thank you so much. Yeah, sun's shining, beautiful weather.
Oh, really?
How about you?
Yeah. Not here.
Not here. Okay.
It's, I don't know, whatever. We don't need to talk about the weather. So, we're actually talking about a book you are currently working on for Manning on performance engineering in practice. I was lucky enough to actually do a little bit of technical review of some of the first few chapters. And coming off of actually just finally was published a book on sustainability in computing. Now no one cares about it. Performance and sustainability and cost can obviously all cross over a little bit.
Absolutely.
And yeah, I found some of your use cases quite interesting. Let's open up maybe with why did you want to create this? Like, what's your background? Why now? Et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, great question. Thanks, Chris. And congratulations on the book yourself. I just had a quick look at it yesterday. So great stuff. Where did it all come from? Right. So I've been a software engineer for 25, 26 years. Most of my work has been in the front end. Mm-hmm. So in the browser. But over the last kind of 10 years, I've been doing a lot more full stack work. And been a tech lead as well. So what I found in that kind of transition from just focusing in the browser to focusing on the whole system is that performance issues can creep in from mm-hmm. anywhere. Mm-hmm. You know, what we found when I was working, at Volvo on their checkout flow was that complaints would come in from customers that they weren't able to pay for their items, pay for their cars, mm-hmm. Put down deposits, things like that. Weren't able to make financial selections in a quick enough time, and they were giving up. And I thought, what can we do about this? This is not obviously good for the company, not for the business. It's not good for us as engineers as well, like to be barraged by all this kind of feedback coming in that's taking us away from our feature work that we're actually trying to build, you know, this application and stuff. But we keep getting like every sprint, we keep getting like, you know, this is too slow or this isn't working or what's happened to this. So I sat down and tried to figure out like, what can we do to make this better for our customers to prevent us all going silently like crazy in the engineering room as well. And so what I ended up with from that was this kind of idea that I'm calling Fast by Default, but it's basically just what are all the things you can do for performance and when is the best time to do them? And how can you structure it in a way that means that everything is not always at the end, right? Mm-hmm. So we always, we've always had this problem in engineering that testing is left until too late, right? And so we've had a lot of like movements to kind of shift everything left, right? To do testing more upfront, so test-driven development and involving like your QA team earlier on in the process has helped with that, and that's been really good. But the performance has always been a bit of a tricky one to measure because performance is a very subjective thing and is very much something that you monitor out in the field rather than on your development laptop or So even some of the like test devices that you use to test before you release, like they're not always like the ones that people have. And we were facing like markets where people didn't have very fast internet connections, especially if they were on mobile.
Yeah.
But even the landline connections were not that great either. So most of our complaints were coming from certain regions of the world. And that forced us to think about how we were going to solve the problem. And in particular, I took that on myself to try and figure out what can we do, like what can developers do in our team to improve performance like earlier on, so that we don't have to have this, what I've been calling the performance decay cycle, where everything just, you build a feature, you don't really consider performance more than, you know, the stuff that makes it work okay on your machine. You release it, you get the feedback back from customers saying this is slow. It feeds back into your bug system, Linear or yeah. Jira or whatever. And then, you know, you end up having to have like a performance sprint every few sprints because, you know, all these issues have stacked up. That gets in the way of building new features, and the business gets disappointed because of that. So the business are disappointed because customers are failing to complete their transactions, and the business is disappointed that their new features aren't getting built because of this as well. So it's coming from both ends.
Yeah.
I sat and wrote down all these things that we could possibly do, like, you know, profiling your code, setting performance budgets and goals. What are we going to define as like a good experience? What level, you know, of performance and speed do we need to get to in order to not lose customers? Mm-hmm. You know, how can we feed that back in a way that developers can use and build during their development time without it, you know, hindering them, particularly from getting their feature work out the door? And also, how can we make sure that there's some kind of automated way of checking this, so that even if all of that fails and someone does a, you know, really quick release that needs to go out, that we have some kind of automated stage there as well that catches anything. And, you know, this is kind of like a filter system kind of thing. It's like you can never fix performance. You know, we're not going to get to a situation where, you know, I click a button and instantly within 0 milliseconds the whole transaction is completed. Yeah. So it's, you know, it's a scale as to like, you know, what's good and what's bad. And so every system is different. You know, every type of application is different in that regard. So for us, in a kind of checkout flow, we want it to be as fast as possible because we don't want to lose that sale. You know, that's the thing that we want. But for another customer, it might be they've built an app that's on the App Store, and you know, the download time to get that app is ridiculously long because it's like 500 megabytes or something. You know, a lot of people are going to give up or not even try to download that in the first place because that like performance cost isn't worth paying for them. But other people, if you structure it in a way so that they're small, you know, the app is a lot smaller to download, and it gets data and downloads data and saves data once you've started the application. The different ways of structuring these things to define what kind of good is for their customers. So we had checkout flows, so yeah. Things had to be pretty fast there. And I know other checkout flows, like I know Shopify, yeah. For example, they spend a lot of attention on their performance side of things, yeah. As well. Like I've been talking to some of their developers, and they're just, you know, every millisecond counts to them because anything that's a potential lost sale is you know, a huge deal for their customers, but for them as a business.
Exactly. You know, yeah. It's kind of interesting with them because they are obviously providing that is their business. For people, when your exactly, core business isn't necessarily that, it's kind of a side of it.
Yeah, exactly.
I sort of wonder, like, how hard is it to justify? I feel like there's been a while where a lot of engineers were kind of, you know, working on the fastest computers, the fastest connections, and always, especially in kind of more back end, you had this ability to just better like throw more resources at it, but that doesn't fix the front end. So I suppose, how do you convince the people that need convincing that it is something that's worth paying attention to?
Yeah, exactly. And that's the most important thing, isn't it? Because those are the people who are going to let you do the work in the first place or say that this is a problem. Mm-hmm. So, in order of for you to kind of explain to the to these people, the stakeholders, like what it is that matters. You don't talk about numbers, or you don't, you know, you don't talk about milliseconds and things like that. You talk about it in their terms, so in business terms. So like, you know, this gap that we have between what we want to achieve and what we have right now is probably costing us, you know, 20% in sales. It's not always as big as that, but you know, these are the tangible things to you. Or like, if what's important to you is, you know, is sheer volume, like it's going to cost us, you know, 300 new app downloads are probably being lost because of this difference. And some of these things are really hard to measure. Like the thing with I mentioned about app downloads, you don't know who didn't click the download, because those are the things you can't get analytics for, right? You don't know who was thinking I was about to do this, but didn't. So those things are, you know, some of that you're going to have to get the data for by just asking customers and doing forums and things like that. And finding out what the real reasons are why customers aren't doing things. Some things you can get from the data, like, you know, if you introduced a performance regression in your checkout flow, for example, and it caused, you know, 500 millisecond delay in the whole process, and you know that during that time sales went down by X percent, you've got something very tangible there to take to the stakeholders and say, look, this is what's happened. If you're able to give us the time to invest, not just in fixing this problem, but by increasing it, you know, improving it, you know, X milliseconds more, or X percent more, we could potentially increase sales here. And that's it's a bit of a curious argument, that one, because a lot of the data that you look at to do with performance says, you know, Amazon have a famous one, right? Where they say every 100 milliseconds, they got their application faster, revenue increased by 1%, right? But they never published the data behind that. And then, you know, it was never known whether that was like a linear graph. Mm-hmm. Like, is it, you know, if their application responds in 400 milliseconds and they improve it to 300 milliseconds, are they actually increasing 1% there? Yeah. Or is the difference actually a little bit further down the line for customers who are on slower connections, where the difference is actually 500 milliseconds and the difference is bigger there? You know, I don't think in that case it's a linear scale. I think there's a point where you get to where it's not worth making those small extra changes, because the amount of development time it would take to get to those extra points is not worth it for the revenue that's coming in. Anyway, that's more of an aside. But yeah, talking to stakeholders in their language, basically, and saying, you know, this is what, finding out what it is that they care about, and finding out what it is in the data that you've got for performance that's, you know, stopping meeting their targets or will help them increase their targets more. I know they often want to be able to report to their, you know, their managers and say, hey, I managed to increase sales by X percent. And so, you know, you're talking in their language and in a way that they are measured against as well. So it's all about measurement in a way.
On measurement, like, how do you offset kind of one measurement against another? So for example, you may be able to reduce the milliseconds on a checkout flow by using vanilla JavaScript, but you've complicated the development process by not using a framework which adds page weight. How do you offset one against the other?
Yeah, well, it's that old thing in software engineering, isn't it? Everything's a trade-off, right? And performance is, you know, like I was just saying, performance is important up to a point. And then, you know, those small, you know, millisecond improvements don't make a difference. And yeah, frameworks, you know, they add page weight, absolutely do. And then that's, you know, has an impact on initial load time. It depends on your architecture, but, you know, your initial load time is potentially, you know, latency time when you're interacting with the application. I'd say that those things that are the most important ones are the things that stop the user from doing what it is that they want to do and create friction. So rather than the framework being the problem, it's like, you know, is typing latency an issue? You know, if it's noticeable that when you type into a field that you know, the cursor's lagging behind what you're typing, things like that cause friction in customers and means that they're less interested in moving forward after that, because if they think, you know, it erodes trust, it takes away that kind of feeling of this is a, you know, this is a good experience. I read some research recently that someone did where they took the exact same website, I think it was, the exact same website. They introduced some delays into one version and kept it pretty fast in the other version and showed it to two different sets of customers. So the exact same like checkout flow, exact same, you know, application. But the ones that saw the version that was kind of degraded, the degraded experience, they said they didn't trust the brand as much as the ones who had the faster experience. They felt less confident in like proceeding with, you know, the next parts of the flow on that site because the fact that the system wasn't responding the way that they expected it to meant that they didn't have confidence, you know, in moving on with the flow and maybe even providing their credit card details at the end. So that's like a really interesting kind of factor as well in this whole performance question as well. So yeah, I'd say things like that where you're blocking people and creating friction is the thing that you want to avoid. So the framework might not be the bottleneck there. You can shave a few milliseconds off the initial load time, but you can also cache a lot of the things that you've been loaded in the first time so that any subsequent visit, you know, you don't have that same, you know, initial like download wait. So, you know, there's plenty of stuff that you can do there to improve performance. And there's a lot of new stuff coming in the browsers that improve this. Some really, really like great compression stuff as well that's coming up. So there's like some very interesting stuff that's coming in there that will improve that initial download time as well. But it's the user experience. And I think one of my early chapters, I start off with saying performance is like one, probably the number one factor for user experience, that and design, I'd say, are probably the two things that customers experience friction with the most. So if you don't have a performant experience, then you don't have happy customers. And then that leads to the whole kind of, you know, trailing off the flow in the end by the end. So
for people who are kind of maybe newer to this, or shall we say at the moment, you know, they've vibe coded their first app and it has performance issues, what are some kind of like easy steps you would recommend for digging in and then solving?
Yeah, actually very interesting, just the AI coding side of it, because AI is great for building and writing code, as you know, but it doesn't always like optimize for performance. It optimizes for correctness, you know, no bugs. It'll write unit tests and check that the code works against those unit tests, and that's great. That's like what it's supposed to do, right? Well, that's what it thinks it's supposed to do anyway. But when you put it out in the real world, you get potentially performance problems. And you've probably seen, as I have, a whole bunch of like anecdotes about people whose performance is completely tanked when they've released their vibe code app on production because, you know, it's doing queries in loops and things like this. So you can ask your agent to use one of the MCP servers. So, for example, I've been using, I still do a lot of work in the browser. I've been using Google Chrome's DevTools. They have an MCP server for that now. And you can ask it to open up a browser and run a bunch of performance measurements, click around in the application, perform some flows, reload the page or restart the flow without reloading the page, and then start that whole process again, and then do it 50 times in a row and see at the end of it, you know, what's the situation with memory usage, you know, do I have like DOM nodes that are lingering around from previous flows, how's the you know, the speed when I'm executing events and stuff like that. So has, you know, input latency taken a hit after all these 50 or 100 or whatever flows that you run through the application? So it's actually really good. So the same tools you're using to write this code that's potentially wrong in the first place can be used to improve it as well. And so you can ask the agent to run this, get the data back at the end of it, and perform like rewrites and refactors to improve the performance, and then run those tests again and prove that it's got to the same place. So you can use AI through this whole flow. It's just, it's not there like from the beginning. So, you know, you write the code you know, as best it can. You know, most of its training data has been on like tutorial data and the basic stuff rather than like the heavy kind of senior work that a lot of us have to do in order to get performance good by the end. So yeah, you can use those same tools to improve performance.
Setting
as well.
Aside those tools, are there some, I mean, you mentioned the web tools, but are there any other, I think I remember in the book you mentioned quite a lot of different ones for different platforms and things like that. You know, one thing a lot of people have, myself included, been using these sort of new tools for is the more native platforms, which have always had a bit more of a learning curve, you know, be it native languages, iOS, Android, et cetera, do they also have good common kind of places where you can do performance investigation? And I imagine on mobile especially, it's still very relevant as well.
Absolutely, they do. Yeah, both Android Studio and Xcode for iOS apps and Mac apps, for that matter, they do have some actually really good performance measurement tools built in. And they measure a lot of the same things I was just talking about with the browser tools. So they measure the memory usage, and they measure interaction speeds and things like that. So all the same kind of things apply. And this is really like part of the idea why I didn't want to limit this book just to the web, even though that's what I know like from 25 years back. All the same kind of performance issues come up across all these different platforms, and they're not limited to one. And the solution, you know, this whole idea of bringing everything earlier back in the flow and creating a kind of development workflow that catches all these performance issues before they go out in production is exactly the same for all of the platforms. Mm. And yeah, there's plenty on the back end as well for measuring like response times and databases and, you know, all the different like components that go up to make like an API endpoint or a system that's doing a lot of processing and stuff. So yeah, there's a great many tools out there. I'd say there's probably a few more that are for the web, because I think historically the web's had more of an issue with performance than backend and mobile apps have. But they're all there, and they're all really, really handy.
It's actually one of those interesting things I found when we were doing the sustainability book. Like, front-end is actually relatively easy to do performance measurement, not necessarily solve the problems. But and the mobile platforms have their tools. I mean, iOS especially has kind of its tool, and that's sort of it. Android, there's a little bit more choice, but actually some of the back-end stuff was where things become a little broader and less defined, because where they run, what they run, how they run is a little unclearer. Did you have any experience and advice on that side of things? I think maybe that is going to be in the book, but you hadn't got to it yet, or yeah.
Yeah, it's quite possible. I can't remember which chapters are published now, but yeah, we do go into a lot of detail. There's a whole like architecture chapter that may already have been released, but I've got like extra material added to it already. But so yeah, the back end, because it's quite a wide span of, you know, what can happen in the back end and the way you structure your application and the way you divide it up. So, you know, some teams have large, you know, monoliths, and others have microservices, and, you know, they're all connected to different types of database. You know, some teams are using just, you know, Postgres, and some are using like, NoSQL databases and things like that. So, you know, there are lots of different choices that you can make on the back end, and they're all dependent on your specific application. So there isn't like, you know, I try not to go in and say, hey, you want to use microservices and you want to use NoSQL databases, because that's not always the right solution. I think I mentioned some teams that that thought they'd made the right choice, and it turns out that they didn't. And by doing a whole kind of refactor of their data layer, they actually managed to improve performance. Even though they thought they were going in with a great performance solution from the beginning. So yeah, and there's all these factors, like how do you handle load? And, you know, if a whole bunch of clients are connected at the same time because there's some, you know, event happening, like say it's Black Friday in America, and, you know, it's a big shopping event and everyone logs on at 9 o'clock in the morning, and is all trying to buy, they're all trying to buy stuff at the same time on your site. You know, how do you handle that kind of load? Do you, you know, if you're in a microservices structure, obviously you can, you know, scale up, but that takes time as well. You know, scaling up isn't an instant thing. When you've got all this traffic going in, you're going to lose traffic. So how do you structure your system to handle that load in the meantime? And sometimes the best way is to deny some traffic and let others through instead of crashing for everybody.
Yeah.
So creating like queue systems and things like this, so you hold some customers back while others are doing their work and then release slowly as time goes on, is a fairly decent way of handling that. So that, you know, the worst thing that can happen is your entire system goes down, because you don't get, you know, any customers. No one's able to buy anything.
Yeah.
You know, you need some kind of limitation in place. So you need like the architecture in place to be able to handle that, and the structures in place, including in your front end, to be able to handle that and display that. I know of like a number of situations where they've had like events like this, like Black Friday, for example, and they found out that you just change a couple of cookies or something in your browser, you can get past the system and get into it anyway. And you know, you want to be able to make sure you have a system where that isn't possible, or at least as you know, much as possible. Like I said earlier, this is like, it's a filtration system through the whole system. You're never going to be able to get to a point where you have like perfect performance that can handle every case. You just want to be able to make sure that, you know, enough people can have enough of a good experience to make their way through, and the rest know what's going on, so that if they're made to wait, you know, they're not left wondering what's happening behind the scenes.
And so Are there other books or advice on this topic? You know, what's your pitch? What are you doing differently or better that you think that should be the reason people read yours?
Well, yeah, thanks. So there are other books on the subject. They tend to focus on one platform almost invariably. I don't think I've seen any other book that covers like, so I try to cover the full stack. So I try to cover what a lot of teams do these days, which is build out a common back end and then build front end applications on top of it. I haven't seen any other books that handle it that way. A lot of blogs, a lot of material, again, they're all focused on one platform. So what I've tried to do is unify everything in one kind of concept or idea that I call Fast by Default. And it's the way that is what I think and have put into practice a few times, and seems to be like a very decent way of structuring and building your applications across the platforms and then at different layers, so they all work together to create a good experience for your users, for your customers, and in a way that helps your business as well. So it's that cross-platform aspect of it. And the fact that I've unified a lot of these ideas about profiling and about code reviewing for performance and all these different factors that come in at different stages throughout the development lifecycle into one kind of concept and one kind of idea that stretches through from beginning to end and means that you don't have to do performance sprints and spend like, you know, a year working on performance improvements. I just was just thinking about the iOS 27 that's supposed to be coming out later this year, where they've spent most of the year working on performance improvements to their underlying like foundations of the iOS, which is great. And they do this at Apple every few years, and a lot of companies do this actually, not just them, where, you know, things just slowly get slower over time until you get to the point where they realize, or customers are complaining about performance, and then, you know, they'll spend a year working on, performance improvements to make it better until, you know, 5 or 10 years down the line.
So it's sort of funny you mentioned that, because of course this is often it's a little different with a company like Apple. They've been around for a long time, but, you know, there's this pressure, especially with a lot of like scaling companies, to always pump out new features. So optimization.
Yeah.
Takes a back seat.
But
I feel like there's also this argument, say we continue with the Apple example, where most people, all they ever really want is a better battery, which is performance. But we've added this new feature that you didn't really ask for. Like, okay, thanks. Yeah. So often there is this, I've been thinking about this a lot, this kind of disconnect between the way that the kind of incentivized market is getting a little bit capitalist here, but the kind of incentivized constant rush for growth versus possibly often what people actually want, which is just to work better or to work longer. And there's a contradiction there, of course. This is not Absolutely. Really performance related, but we see, you know, dark UX patterns in checkouts and things that are intentional. Mm. And of course, I don't know. It's sometimes this balancing act of what you want, what your customers want, but also what the market wants, which is
And another thing, actually, on the sustainability front as well. Like we're entering like a period now where RAM is constrained.
I was actually thinking this. I thought this would be a random question, but like maybe it's not around how. You know, will people for at least a period of time care more about performance? Because suddenly, unsurprisingly, performance has been capped somewhat.
Yeah, exactly. And this, I think, actually is probably, and you know, rather, I don't want to be a skeptic here, but I think this is probably why Apple focused on performance at this exact moment in time, is because they're probably not going to have lots of big, you know, RAM upgrades for their devices, and they're probably going to cut a lot of the higher tier devices, and so they have to improve performance across the system to be able to handle, you know, just that amount of RAM that's there. I wrote a little essay on my blog like a couple of months ago about how, you know, the original Mac OS was managed to fit in 64K of ROM, and you know, the whole windowing system and everything, a quick draw was in there, and the whole graphics you know, handling was all in that really, really, really small space that, you know, we would, you know, no one would blink an eyelid about him, you know, adding an image to their site or application that was 64K in size now. But, you know, we're not restricted in that way with this RAM, you know, problem we've got coming up, but we are going to be constrained. And if RAM is going to become more constrained in the future, which it seems like it will be certainly in the short to medium term, that perhaps performance is something that we need to focus a lot more on, and we get more kind of bang for our buck, and we're not wasting cycles, and we're not... you know, wasting all these resources that we have. I don't think that this is like an aside at all. I think this is very core to the kind of thing that we're looking at right now.
In related, much like the book that I mentioned, we started out 2 years or so ago about thinking we should have AI in there somewhere. We should probably add a chapter to, well, maybe the whole book could have. And it's sort of similar, like, now a lot of companies and products are adding in model access, local or remote. It brings in other performance concerns. Is that something you're also going to cover in the book? Or
AI is a very interesting one. It's so powerful, right? So I talk about AI coding, I talk about AI code reviewing, and I talk about AI in the context of the different chapters that I have. I thought about having like an AI chapter, but I feel like AI it's a tool, you know, it's something that we use to do our jobs, you know, better, more productively, or can help our customers better. So it fits in more in like in the individual, you know, sections of the book that I've already laid out. And you can use AI to help you with profiling, and you can use it to help with, you know, code reviews, all these things that are there, and they can help out the whole process. But AI is also, you know, the interfaces as well, the chat interfaces where you type in a prompt, and then you have to wait, like, depending on your model, you know, some time for, you know, the system to respond and to start producing those tokens that, you know, then stream in. And like that's like, in a way, like performance, we'd made a lot of great strides towards like perceived performance and making applications feel faster, even if they weren't behind the scenes. And we've got to the point where we're kind of limited again in the systems that we have, like that are running these models, that they're, you know, slow in generating that their responses, or at least the initial response. So you have something to start reading in your chat interface before the rest of it loads. So I think like local models are great in that regard. You know, they speed things up immensely for that initial inference, but there's still a gap. Mm. So perceived performance is becoming another like factor in applications again, as we kind of gotten away from. So I'm covering that in some later chapters in my book, and what you can do about that, how you can make customers feel like they're not waiting on something when they are actually waiting on something, and kind of giving them something else to do in the meantime that's productive for their applications in question as well, as productive as you can be in some of these scenarios.
Productive is a
it depends what you're doing, but yeah,
it's kind of like, you know, it used to be, oh, I'm waiting for it to compile, and it's like, I'm waiting for the agent to answer.
Yeah, exactly, the waiting stage.
All right, then, I'm sure we will have a sort of customized link in the show notes for the what do you call it again, the MEAP.
Yeah.
All the vowels. But when do you anticipate the book coming out, roughly?
So where are we now? It's summertime. Yeah, it should be out, completed before the end of the year. We were aiming for the fall. I'm still hoping that we'll reach that. So yeah, probably, hopefully sometime around October, November, we should be looking at the published book and all 20 chapters of it. So yeah. But look out for more chapters in the meantime. We're going to be releasing more as I get even more written. So
also,
progress is good. So yeah, all on track.
And for you, is there any kind of website you have or anything like that where you'd like people to look at for you and your other activities?
Yeah, you can look at my personal site, denodell.com. There I write a bunch of essays about performance, but also about other things that I care about as well, like accessibility and user experience and stuff as well there. I'm building out a site to go with the book, fastbydefault.com. And that right now just explains the kind of the, you know, some of my thinking behind the process. But I'm going to be adding in tools in there and links to all the things that I suggest in the book, so that you know, people have a what kind of one-stop resource for getting all the links in one place as well. So that will be building out over the next few months too.
Awesome. Okay. Dan, thank you very much for your time.